OWC Radio 2.0, episode number 15, a special conversation and interview with Peter Cohen. And as I said, it is OWC Radio 2.0, episode number 15. I'm Tim Robertson. My special guest this week is Peter Cohen. Now, for those who don't know, Peter Cohen is kind of a staple in the Apple community. He started writing about Macs, specifically Mac games, actually, all the way back into 1994. He actually beat me by 1 year getting into the Mac scene professionally. And from there, Peter Cohen was kind of a tech professional until he sold out to the man. He sold his Mac gaming site, I believe, to Macworld, correct?
Actually, I sold it to Mac Central.
Mac Central, yes.
And then Mac Central sold themselves to Macworld.
That's right. That would have been Stan's publication, and then he sold to Macworld, and you became a senior editor at Macworld for a while.
Yeah, for about a decade.
That's a long time. Let's before we move on, let's lament that fact. It came out this week that, well, actually last week, that Macworld magazine is no more. They're going to continue publishing online as a website, but the physical magazine, IDG, has shut down that division. That magazine is, I think, one or two issues left, and then they're done.
Yeah, the November issue is going to be the last issue ever of Macworld magazine. So, go to the newsstand if you don't subscribe, buy it, and put it under glass someplace, because it'll be a collector's piece, I'm sure. I'm very sad to find that out. I have some really good friends who I worked with for a very long time there. Some of the most talented people I've ever worked with in my life were there at the end, and I'm very sorry to see them go. Having said that, I'm very excited that Macworld's losses are gain at iMore.com. We were able to hire Serenity Caldwell.
Oh, good.
As a result of that. So, Serenity is landing safely, and I'm sure that everybody else is going to land safely too. They are just such an incredibly great bunch of people with so much talent. There's no way that they're not going to do well.
This couldn't surprise you, really, about a physical magazine stopping publication. I mean, there's no way that could surprise you.
No way. No, I mean, the publishing market is in a lot of trouble. And look, I lost my job at Macworld in 2009, not because I mooned anybody, but contrary to popular belief. No, just kidding. But, as part of the continued downsizing of print that had already been underway for years. So it wasn't any surprise to me at all that Macworld finally ceased publication. In fact, I guess it could be argued that I was surprised it lasted as long as it did. And I think that that's a testament in part to how beloved the magazine was by the senior execs at IDG, International Data Group, the company that owns Macworld, to keep it alive in the face of dwindling subscriptions. But, every month that thing showed up, it looked a little thinner. The ratio between advertising and editorial content in a print publication needs to stay a certain balance.
Yeah.
In order for them to afford to be able to print it, because contrary, I think, to a lot of people's belief, the subscription price that you pay does not pay for the magazine.
No, it doesn't even come close.
It's the it's the advertising that makes a magazine profitable. And, every month when, you get a few more pages less in the magazine, it's because advertisers aren't forking over what they need to in order to keep the publication afloat. So,
and that's because less and less people are subscribing and reading that magazine. If there was still a lot of people reading and getting Macworld, it wouldn't have been a problem. The advertisers wouldn't have gone anywhere. But the fact was, more and more people, especially the newer generation of Mac users, they weren't getting that magazine. They were getting their content online.
Yeah, no, I mean, you look at the sale of Macs and you say to yourself, and I've seen some of our colleagues, Tim, on Twitter and other social networks saying, how is it possible that Apple is selling so many Macs and a publication like Macworld can't stay afloat? It must be IDG's fault. It isn't, because the people who are buying Macs these days aren't interested in Macworld. They're not getting their information from Macworld. In fact, many of them aren't getting information at all about the computers that they're using. They're strictly using their computers as appliances, as something to run email on, as something to access the web with, as something to pay bills with, maybe something to entertain the kids or the grandkids with. But they're not the computer enthusiasts or the IT professionals or the creative professionals that kept the Macintosh a cult scene for so many years and made it possible to have publications like Mac Week, Mac User, Mac Addict yep. back in the day, Mactivity. You know,
Mactivity was a good one. That was in the UK. That was a great one.
Yeah, you know, so it's a sad fact that, you know, that we have evolved in a way where Apple is selling a lot more Macs than they ever sold before, but they're selling them to a very different group of people that just aren't as interested in making the Mac as central in their lives as people who made all those magazines possible back in the day did. Plus, the way that we get information has totally changed.
Yeah, right? Our magazines are in our pocket. It's called an iPhone now.
Right, exactly. You know, you'd subscribe to it in newsstand on the iPad if you're lucky, mm-hmm. or if the publisher is lucky. But for a lot of people, you know, hitting a daily site is enough, if that. And that's, I think, why IDG is continuing with Macworld.com and not the print pub.
And it is sad. I mean, Macworld magazine launched the same day that the Macintosh launched. So it was as old as the platform itself. So I am sorry to see it go. I like I said, I'm not surprised, but there's a lot of great content that people are going to and have been going to get their information, their Mac fix. And iMore is one of them. You are a managing editor at iMore. You've been there for over a year now, haven't you?
Yeah, I started, I think, April of 2013. So I've been there for a little over a year. Yep.
So how do you like that gig?
I love it. I cannot remember the last time I worked with a bunch of people who are so talented and so motivated to just do the best jobs that they could. I work with some great people. Renee Ritchie is the editor-in-chief. He is an absolute terror, his energy level. He does a billion podcasts and writes a million words and sets, you know, just by doing what he does, he sets an impossible standard to meet for anybody else. It's just incredible stuff. And everybody at Mobile Nations is like that. It's a really great group of people.
So you're not new to podcasting. This isn't virgin territory for you here doing this show. You did your own podcast, Angry Mac Bastards, from 2009 to what, 13?
Yeah.
And so five years?
Yeah. And I was a weekly about three. I guess I was with it for a little more than 3 years before I decided to stop doing it. But I was a weekly fixture on Sean King's show.
Yeah. Your Mac Life?
Your Mac Life and the Mac Show before that, yep. For probably well over a decade. Back to the Mac Central days. So, yeah, I've been podcasting for a long time.
Are you surprised that podcasting has kind of evolved into what it is, or is it kind of right on course? And do you think there's room to grow in the podcasting world?
I think, yeah, there is. I think that there's a lot of room to grow in the podcasting world. I think that as technology has made it easier and easier for people to subscribe to and listen to podcasts while they're doing other things, whether it's driving home from work or, you know, commuting or working out or, you know, just sitting around at work or at home, I think that, you know, podcasts have gotten more and more interesting to people as a way of getting information and staying in touch. And I think that that's good for all of us because people who podcast, we need to continue to up our game to make them more professional and to make them more engaging and to make them more interesting to people. So it's you know, a rising tide raises all boats in that respect.
I've been saying for many years now that podcasting really has no rules, that we can make what we want of it. And I think it's probably one of the only mediums that can do that. Maybe YouTube is the same, but even then, there's rules on YouTube. Podcasting is whatever we want it to be. So if you're a content creator, what a fabulous medium. What a perfect way to get your content out there and do it the way you want to do it. It's very unique. It's something that never existed, this kind of a distribution method, this kind of creative freedom. Putting the financials to the side for a minute, I've never seen anything like this my entire life, not even the web up to a certain point. I mean, this is, it's so different than anything that came before or since. And I think that we need more creative people in the podcasting sphere, but that's just me. Let's go back in time. Let's go 1994 and Mac gaming. How did you start Mac gaming, and what was really, how did you get into computers? What was the driving factor for you?
Well, I've been a Mac user for about 29 years now. I got into the Mac back in 1985. When Apple rolled out the Mac, I hadn't used Apples before then. I mean, I'd used them in school. I was in high school at the time. And our data processing class used Apple IIcs. But when the Macintosh came out, I was really, really interested in it. I'd been using computers since I was about 8 or 9 years old. When I was a little kid, I was raised by a single parent. My mom raised me. And she enrolled me in the Big Brother program. Uh-huh. And one of the Big Brothers that that she introduced me to was this guy named Ron. And Ron was a system analyst for one of the big telecom companies. And he came home one day with a TRS-80 Model mm-hmm. 1.
Wow.
And he hooked it up to this little monitor that you could buy from Tandy at the time and plugged it in and turned it on. And then there was this flashing cursor on the screen and a command line prompt. And I said, okay, so what do you do with it? And he said, well, you can do anything with it. And I said, well, can you play games on it? Because, you know, I'm sure. Kid, this is the first thing I wanted to do. And he said, sure. And I said, cool, how do you play games on it? And he says, well, you write them. And I was like, okay. Well, how do you write them was my next question. And we spent like the next 2 or 3 weekends that we would spend together inputting a basic program into the TRS-80's memory. And I remember that he had a cassette drive that he could use to save stuff.
Backing it up to tape.
Yeah, but I mean, we wrote this out all longhand, you know, in a college-ruled notebook, you know. You would write out at the time, you know, in BASIC, you would write out line numbers, so 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, all the way down the page. And then, you know, REM for a mark, you know, Space Invaders by Peter Cohen. and then, you know, I slowly cobbled this game together. And the game didn't have flashy graphics or anything, but it was kind of cool. And it was a math game, actually, that had spaceships and laser blasts on it, where you could enter numbers. And I just thought it was amazing that I and Ron had put this thing together. And that started my love affair with computers. So, you know, I was, I think, 12 when I finally got my own computer. Bill Cosby was pushing him when he wasn't selling Jell-O pudding.
Yeah, I remember.
It was the TI-99-4A. I eventually figured out that I could put in, I could make the screen, show really pretty color graphics, if I put in data strings. And, using colored graph paper, I could put together, graphics that would print on the screen. And the way that I did it would be that I would draw a picture on the graph paper, and then I would divide the graph paper into 8x8 quadrants, and I would convert those 8x8 quadrants into hexadecimal notation that corresponded to whether or not the bits in that particular row were on or off. And it was an arduous process for me to do a single page, a single screen. Would take days, sometimes weeks, depending on what I was working on. But at the end, I would run the program in BASIC, and it would appear on the screen, and I was very proud of myself. So I was at a computer fair in 1984, and I saw a guy with this little beige computer on a desk, and I said, what's this? And he says, it's a Macintosh. And I'm like, how do you use it? And he showed me Mac Paint, and the top of my head exploded.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to explain to someone that's of not our generation what that was like to see a graphical user interface, a mouse, and to be able to change the screen. You can just draw right on it, and it was amazing.
So that was it. From then on, you know, I've been a Mac user, and I've dabbled with other platforms. You know, I had a PC for a while. I had a Commodore Amiga for a while, but I've always come back to the Mac. And almost since I was old enough to work, one way or the other, you know, my first summer job in high school was duplicating Mac software for a local developer. I've always had my foot in the Mac business. So in the 90s, I was in IT, and I was working for a graphic design company, and I knew we all knew that the web was going to be like really big for us somehow, but none of us had any practical experience putting together web pages. So I said to myself, I've got to figure out how to publish web stuff, but how am I going to do this in such a way that I'm going to keep interested in it long enough to stick with it so I can learn new things over time?
Right.
And my real fascination at the time was with video games, not just any video games, but classic video games that have been made for the Macintosh.
Oregon Trail and stuff like that.
Well, classic video games. So, you take a video game, a coin-op video game like Asteroids.
Oh, okay, I got you.
And Ambrosia Software made a game called Maelstrom that was an Asteroid-style game. So it was providing people who were visiting the page with information on those sorts of games. And, eventually I started getting copies of games in the mail, or companies would say, hey, do you want to, can you download this over the internet? Can you grab this off of a BBS or something and review it for your readers so they know about it? And I've been publishing websites ever since.
It's a long time. It's a totally different world. I mean, that was 1994. It's 2014. That's 20 years. And are you surprised at how far gaming has come on computers? I mean, because now you have to lump in iOS in there as well.
I'm surprised that gaming still sucks as badly as it does.
It does in some respects. And I got to be honest with you. I've talked on this podcast and the other show that I do. I'm way into MAMES right now. In fact, I got an arcade cabinet. I think you saw a picture of it, actually.
Yeah.
I've always been into the classic video games. I'm kind of pushing back on the newer stuff. I don't even have a PS4 or an Xbox One yet. A lot of people that know me is surprised. And I'm like, yeah, I'm more into the classic arcade games right now. That's kind of where my fun is. I don't particularly like setting them up and getting them working. I like actually playing them. And I'm not a collector. I don't care if I have the original this or it's pristine that. I just want to play the games because they were fun.
I think it's really interesting. I have the same X-Arcade tank stick that you do. It's an amazing piece of hardware.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I catch a lot of flack for it from hardcore MAME guys that, you got to build your own. And I don't care about building my own. I just want to sit down and play it.
When you start saying build your own, all I can see is a little Linux graybeard sitting behind a big bag of, unless you compile your own kernel, I'm sorry. I can't possibly talk to you about the intricacies of GNU Linux. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
It's an awesome piece of hardware. It's accessible and, it's a lot of fun. And I'm right there with you. I love the classic arcade games. I spent so much time, as I'm sure you did, Tim, with a pocket full of quarters.
Oh, yes. Too many.
You drop a buck here or $2 there. Remember lining up your quarters in the top of the machine to let everybody know that you had next game?
And standing so close to the player who was playing that the cigarette smoke coming off of his cigarette that's sitting on the arcade game itself and getting precariously closer and closer to the actual control panel is burning your eyes, but you don't care. If you move, you're going to lose your place, and somebody else is going to jump on Tempest next.
Exactly.
Yep.
It's a fond memory, and I think there's a point in your life that's very formative. And, for me, I'm in my mid-40s now. It was that period when I was about 15, 16, 17 years old playing video games in arcades. And, every day at lunch, I remember, the high school that I went to, right downstairs from it was in an urban area. There was a cafe that had a couple of arcade games. Spent all my time playing Gauntlet and Arkanoid and games like that. And it's a very fond sense memory of that time, but it also really kind of formed a very personal connection with me with those games that enable me to lose myself in those games in a way that I don't when I'm playing Destiny or Grand Theft Auto or World of Warcraft or whatever now. You know, I just don't find myself as immersed in that as I do in the old games.
I would agree with you to a point, although I do like GTA games. I do like some of the newer ones. I will play them for a long time, but then when I stop playing them, I rarely, if ever, go back to them. But yet, I find myself going back to Ms. Pac-Man just to see if I can get that high score again. So there's definitely something to that. But I will say, with iOS and Android to a lesser degree, mobile games is kind of becoming that. There's some nostalgia factor there, but I'm seeing a lot of creativity in the mobile platform that I just don't see in the expensive consoles. And do you agree with that, or do you see, I mean, there's a lot of junk out there. Let's be honest. There's just a lot of chafe. But that being said, there's some real great gems, just fantastic games on mobile now that kind of blows me away that it's this much fun to play these games.
I think that, yeah, and yes, I do agree with you. I think that mobile is it's exciting for a lot of reasons, and I think that that part of it is because developers have to find new ways to engage players. You know, what we've found over and over again is that you can't port, you know, a game from a console or from a PC and expect mobile gamers to get it or to want to play it. You know, they want something that's original. They want something that's unique to their platform, and they want something that's fun and engaging. The thing that worries me, though, the most about mobile games is free-to-play.
Yeah, that's something that it has really worried me for a long time as well. Free-to-play sounds like what a great idea, but it could really ruin the entire platform, the way they're throwing up these roadblocks and they're deceptive and it ends up costing more money than if I could have just bought the whole thing for $10 or $20 to begin with.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think that a couple of companies have tried to get out of that mold by doing some really creative things. Like, you know, you get to a certain point where you've paid enough for the product and the product gets unlocked completely. But, you know, I don't see that as a good long-term solution to what we're talking about. And at this point, it's become a lottery. Yeah. For game developers, unfortunately. You know, mobile game developers need to have a big hit in order to make it big, but the chances of them having a big hit are infinitesimal. And the signal-to-noise ratio on the App Store or in Google Play or anywhere else that you can download mobile apps from is ridiculous. You know, it's so hard to differentiate junk from quality.
And the reviews don't help, that's for sure.
Reviews don't help. You know, user-led reviews are worse than useless because, you know, people are completely arbitrary about the way that they'll review products. Oh, I like the icon, 5 stars, you know, or it didn't work.
Or the developers themselves, some of the unsavory ones are gaming those
reviews. Are gaming the reviews themselves, exactly. So, you know, it's there's a lot of Wild West stuff going on out there that I don't like. But I'm hoping long-term that we're going to have some good content available for mobile for a long time.
So where do you see the Mac going? There was a lot of people, there was a few people for a while that was worried that Apple would abandon the Mac because they're having so much success with the iPads and the iPhones. I said, ridiculous, that's not going to happen. Apple comes out with a Mac Pro, which is, it's a fast machine, but I don't get it, to be honest. The Mac Mini has been upgraded since, I don't know, 1977?
2012, but yeah.
And they come out with these machines like the iMac that prohibits people from even opening them. So I wonder what your opinion is of what Apple's doing with the Mac now.
You know, if this were 10 years ago, I'd have a very different opinion of what Apple's doing than I do now. I think that 10 years ago, it was really necessary for a lot of people who were buying Macs to crack them open and upgrade the hardware themselves, whether it was adding new RAM or installing a new hard drive or what have you. These days, I see it as becoming less and less of an issue because Apple is shipping systems that are good and that are going to be good for a good long time. And you can't design something like an iMac you know, with the expectation of being able to pull out the video card and replace it with a better video card, because it's custom hardware. You know, it's not something that can accommodate an expansion card like you could on a, you know, a do-it-yourself PC, for example. And a do-it-yourself PC is going to be a good solution for that group of people, but they're not going to have something as beautifully designed, as elegant, and as integrated and well-tested as an iMac is. You know, so in that respect, I don't think that Apple's doing anything wrong the way that they're doing it now. You know, as far as the Mac Pro and the Mac Mini are concerned, I have a strong suspicion that Apple's going to be refreshing the Mac Mini before too long. That's an important machine from them. Not only is the Mac Mini their entry-level machine and a good hook for getting people who are switching from the PC platform to Mac for the first time and, you know, already have hardware that they want to reuse, like keyboards, mice, monitors, but it's also an important machine for IT people, you know, because it's a great workgroup server. It can run in the email server, file service. It can do web. It can do...
it can actually do anything with virtualization.
It can do anything with virtualization. You're absolutely right. But it is getting long in the tooth. And that's because underneath the hood, the Mac Mini is essentially a 13-inch MacBook Pro, you know, what we call in the business an MD-101 model.
Yep.
Without a screen, you know, or a keyboard. It's the same guts as that standard 13-inch Pro that's still part of the product line. But Apple's going to have to move it forward at some point or another. I don't know if that means replacing it with a Broadwell chip once those are available, or you know, bringing it just up to Haswell spec, like a Retina MacBook Pro would be, for example, or a MacBook Air. But they're going to have to do something with it. And It needs to stay in the product line for the reasons that I just outlined.
Yeah.
The Mac Pro is a fantastic machine, but it's also pretty rarefied. You know, I don't think that Apple sells a lot of Mac Pros. You know, I don't see them out in the world a lot. And the people who are using them are people who really need the horsepower, people who are doing high-end digital content creation that they can't do on an iMac as effectively, or scientists. You know, my particular shop, the shop where I work on the weekends, we sell them to marine biologists at one of the local marine biological laboratories.
Wow, awesome.
Yeah, so those are the people who are using it. They're doing stuff like gene sequencing on these things. You know, they're doing high-end computational work that you can really benefit from having, you know, a fast as Hades machine like a Mac Pro.
Apple did have a fairly large event last week. You might have seen it out there a little bit.
Oh, really? Yeah. No, I didn't hear anything about it.
And, you know, on last week's show, I said I'm going to get a iPhone 6 Plus. And I've actually changed my mind. I'm going to stick with my 5S for a while, I think. Probably, I don't know if I'll last through Christmas, but that's kind of my plan right now. I'm going to hold off because I'm a little worried of it being a new SKU and reliability and how rigid such a large screen is. So I'm going to hold off for a little bit, but I do want to get your opinion on everything that we saw last week. Well, not everything, but a lot of it. But first, you wrote an article for iMore in which you address the people that are loudly complaining that, oh my gosh, they got a free album from Apple. How dare they?
Yes. Yes. So, you know, at the end of Apple's announcement this past week, Tim Cook introduced U2. U2 played a song called The Miracle of Joey Ramone, which is from a new album. And Tim Cook then announced that new album, which is entitled Songs of Innocence, is now in everybody's iTunes.
Yep. They gave it away for free.
And giving it away for free in Apple's case was kind of an interesting exercise, because what they did is they added it to every active, and are continuing to add it to every active, newly active iTunes account and every existing iTunes account as a purchased item, rather than simply sending out, let's say, 800 million redemption codes to people and saying, here, download it at your whim. They actually just added it to your existing library. And herein lies the crux of many people's complaints, because they're upset. The ones who are upset about it are upset because this was added to their library without their consent. And for many people, complaining about receiving this free album that would have cost $10 otherwise or whatever. It is perceived that Apple has violated their privacy somehow.
Yeah, and I got that.
And in fairness, I understand where some of them are coming from. You know, if you've set your system to automatically download any new albums from iTunes, it is a little bit jarring to all of a sudden find new music on there.
Give you an example of that. My daughter, my oldest daughter, who's in second year of college, second or third year now, I forget. That's how old I'm getting. Actually sent up on Facebook, because she wasn't paying attention to this Apple event. She could care less. She has a Mac, she has an iPhone, but that's because I'm her dad. And she likes them, but she's not into tech at all. She, as long as it works, she's happy. I saw a Facebook post from her 2 days after the event that said, anybody know why I have a U2 album on my iPhone that I didn't buy? And of course, you know, a couple people replied, oh, it was a free giveaway from Apple, and she was like, oh, okay, cool. Now, had Apple just sent out an email to subscribers to tell them that they were going to do this, which they never did, I think that would have mitigated some of the issues, but it's almost that Apple assumed that everybody had watched this keynote or read about it and was excited to get a free album. I was excited to get the free album. I like YouTube a lot. I was excited to get this album. But I can understand why not everybody would be, and it caused confusion. But what I don't understand is the anger. I don't get that.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that the internet rage machine produces an irrational amount of anger in people. And as I said in my editorial, I think that the response to the U2 release was so far off the scale of normal behavior, I started to wonder about the mental state of some of the people who were going on about it. They were comparing it to being raped or to having the NSA look at their stuff, which is just so ridiculous. It's incredible to me that they can actually seriously make this kind of comparison. You know, I understand why people might feel a little uneasy and, you know, gee, is this just a one-time thing or am I going to be getting new albums every week? What am I going to have to deal with here? But there's also, you know, reflecting and amplifying the initial negative reaction of some of these people are bloggers who are just opportunistically looking for a chance to promote traffic. And unfortunately, propagating some myths like it's impossible to delete or you can only listen to it in the cloud, you can't download it, so the music's not really yours. Just, I've read all sorts of horse crap about this album. You know, the album's just like anything else. Yeah, it's in your purchase library. Yeah, you can hide the purchase. And if you don't like it, you can delete it off your phone. You can delete it off your Mac with no ill consequences. And what's more, yesterday, on Monday of this week, Apple actually published a way that you can use to delete it and have it darken your doorstep never again. So, you know, if you want to remove this, then go ahead. But, you know, just shut up about getting a free thing. I can't think of a better definition of a first world problem than I feel violated because Apple and U2 gave me a free thing I don't want.
I even read some articles that said Apple's always been biased towards rock music like this. And here's another example. It's U2. Why not Dr. Dre? He's part of Apple now. Why not a country album? Why not over and over and over? And I didn't respond to any of these, of course, but I thought U2, whether you like them or not, I don't think anybody could really argue that they are the biggest band in the world now. I mean, who even comes close? The Rolling Stones? I don't think so. They're the biggest band in the world. And if Apple's going to do a promotion like this, I think it makes sense that they work with the biggest band in the world. And I don't get it. I really don't. It seemed like a very nice gesture on Apple's part, because you know they paid U2. It's not like U2 donated this album to Apple to give away.
Bono was very careful to make that distinction.
Yes. Yes.
You know, on stage with Tim Cook, like, you paid for this.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, there's no question that Apple paid a lot of money, but Apple paying a lot of money for something and the rest of us paying a lot of money for something.
Yeah, two different things.
There's no comparison. It's sort of like, you know, some small country paying – U2 to give away a free album. You know, it's some large, medium-sized countries, for that matter. You know, Apple.
Well, if you go by revenue, they'd probably be in the top 10.
Right. You know, Apple. Apple is the biggest consumer electronics company on the planet. One of the most successful companies. Period. So. You know, it's a drop in the bucket for them. It was a nice gesture. I'm trying very hard not to look a gift horse in the mouth. I'm kind of ambivalent about U2. If, you know, funnily enough, being the age that I am, I don't have any U2 albums besides Song of Innocence in my iTunes library. Just never been a band that I've ever caught into, really. But having said that, I've listened to Songs of Innocence with open ears. I've enjoyed it. I'm happy to have it, and I'm grateful that Apple and U2 were able to put it together. I just wish people could be a little more gracious about it and a little less bitchy.
Yeah, you know, that I think that's, to me, that's what it comes down to. How about you just be gracious that you got something for free? You didn't even have to ask. They just gave it to you for free. And you're going to complain. Of course you are.
Yep.
So Apple comes out with the new iPhones. They actually go on sale this week, this Friday. I will say, is it tomorrow or Thursday that Apple comes out with iOS 8? That's tomorrow, isn't it?
That Wednesday. Is Wednesday, yes.
Yeah. I've got to be honest. I'm right at this moment, because I've decided to hold off buying an iPhone, I'm very, very excited about the new iOS. Are you upgrading iOS immediately when it comes out?
Oh, of course. But, you know, it's an occupational hazard.
Sure.
For me. I actually would advise against upgrading to it right away for anybody who can wait.
Someone else find the bugs, or it's just going to take so long to download it could leave you without a phone for hours?
Well, possibly both, but mainly A. You know, we all depend on our phones, crucially, to be able to, you know, not only make phone calls, but also to be able to stay in touch with the people and the places and the things that we think are really important. And when you're upgrading your phone's operating system, no matter how well tested that operating system may be, things can go wrong. So at the very least, I encourage anybody who's listening to this to make sure to back up their phone before they do it. But understand that when it comes to upgrading an operating system, this is a one-way trip. Apple doesn't let you downgrade if you don't like it, or something goes horribly awry and your phone stops working. iOS 8, just like iOS 7 and iOS 6 before it, is a one-way trip. You know, Apple will no longer sign the certificate saying that you are able to run iOS 7 on your device, and that's it for you once you've upgraded. So think carefully, think thoughtfully before you do it, and you know, actually take a look at the feature set of iOS 8 and decide that if it's something that you absolutely need or just something that you want. You know, if it's something that you need, if there are features in it that you need, then by all means upgrade. But if it's just stuff that you want, you might just want to take a step back for a day or two and wait for things to settle down a little bit. Wait for the smoke to clear and see where the bodies are lying and get a better idea of whether or not there are any bugaboos that are going to bite you in particular, and figure out if it's going to be worth it to you to chance it for right now, or whether you're better off waiting maybe a week or two before you make the leap.
I would agree with that. Unfortunately, I think most people listening to it, including me, is going to make the leap immediately.
Well, sure.
It's just, you were forewarned.
But I would say for those of you who are listening today who have less sophisticated friends, neighbors, and relatives who come to you for advice, just play back what I just said to them.
There you go. Absolutely.
You know?
You work in an Apple specialist. I've worked in one last year when iOS 7 came out, and I could tell you there was a line out the door of people who updated and were not happy. And we were the nearest Apple presence, so we caught the end of that sharp stick, and it wasn't fun. People were very upset, and you know, they just didn't understand what they were getting into. So like Peter just said, if you have relatives, friends, family, whatever, and they come to you for advice, hey, I see this new iOS 8 is out, should I update it? If they are not technically savvy, tell them to wait for a little bit. You're doing yourself a favor. And let's be honest, you're still at a specialist. You're going to see a lot of people come in angry about this update. It's just going to happen.
I plan to double my anti-anxiety meds on Saturday morning in preparation for what life is going to be like when we have these people stumbling in the door, you know, just tearing at their shirts and ripping their hair out because their devices aren't working anymore. And, you know, the fortunate thing that I think that we've got going into iOS 8 is that it's not going to be as jarring a user experience as going from iOS 6 to iOS 7 was. But, you know, what happens is people get a message saying you've got an update on your phone. Do you want to install it? And they just reflexively click OK without understanding what that update is and what it means. Hopefully, you know, the memory or the trauma of upgrading to iOS 7 is still fresh enough in their minds that they'll be like, no.
It won't happen.
Yeah, but I know that a lot of people are going to come in the door on Saturday just upset that their phone isn't working the way that they expected it to, or what is this new thing? I don't understand it. I fear change. Life is horrible. Make it stop.
Now, do you think iOS 8 is going to be a significant enough change for people that have, let's say, an iPhone 5 or 5S or even a 5C that was on the fence about the new iPhones, that they're going to get this update, it's going to feel in a lot of respects like a brand new phone, and they're going to go, you know what, I'm just going to hold on to this for a while now?
Well, good for them if they do that. I mean, a lot of people are on two-year upgrade cycles too, right? Because despite the best efforts that T-Mobile, Verizon, and the other cell phone carriers here in the United States have made to try to get people to upgrade every 6 months or annually, a lot of people are still in two-year contracts. And for those people who have 5S's or 5C's they've just gotten in the last year, they're going to be stuck with them for a while before they're going to be eligible to upgrade. And that's fine. You know, for others, I think that if iOS 8 does what you need, then why should you upgrade to a new phone? You know, I've got a 5S and I am definitely getting a 6, but I don't feel the need for a new phone. And I'm hoping that my sense is very similar to what a lot of regular people, the people that I call muggles, are dealing with. You know, I just think that maybe they're going to get iOS 8 and they're going to be happy with some of the new features. But if they're going to want to use stuff like Apple Pay or, you know, the other new features that are specific to the iPhone 6 and the iPhone 6 Plus, you know, it's buy a new phone or just deal with it without.
The iPhone 5S is the first phone that I've had when a new phone came out that I went, nah, I'm okay. It's the 5S is a fantastic phone. It's almost perfect in every way other than battery life, to be honest. And I know all the tricks to save battery life, but it doesn't get the best battery life by far. The new phones, the new iPhone 6, and especially the 6 Plus, looks like it's much, much better in that regard. But even with that, the 5S is just such a brilliant piece of hardware that I don't feel the need to rush right out and buy the latest and greatest.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I've got the 5S too, and I don't feel like I've, you know, even come close to scratching the surface of what the thing can do, or for that matter, that the software developers whose apps I've installed on it are really, you know, stressing it out too much.
I mean, the camera is brilliant on it. It takes great video and great pictures, still pictures. It's got all the capacity that I need. It's a fabulous screen. I mean, it's brilliant. And yet, there's a new iPhone coming out, and I still want it, but I just don't feel the burning need to get it. And like I said a little while ago, the 6 Plus was the one that I kind of want because I want a bigger screen. I've always wanted one since the original iPhone, to be honest. Which one do you think you're going to go with?
I have pretty much made up my mind at this point that I'm going to go with an iPhone 6 as opposed to a 6 Plus, although I'm still waiting to get them in my hands before I make a final decision. I haven't pre-ordered. And as a matter of fact, I wrote an editorial about this over the weekend for iMore, talking about why I haven't pre-ordered an iPhone 6 yet. But, you know, the iPhone 6 fundamentally changes the form factor of the iPhone. You know, we're done with the 4-inch screen and we're moving up to 4.7, and that's a different feel. It's a different feel in the pocket. It's different dimensions. And I want to feel both of them in my hand before I make a final decision. But I'm edging, you know, just my gut tells me that I'm probably going to go for the iPhone 6 as opposed to the 6 Plus, because 5.5-inch screens, I've seen phones that big. I know that Apple's design is going to be better than those other phones I've seen, but that's just more than I'm willing to jam down my pants at any given time.
And most people put them in cases, and a 5.5-inch screen now wrapped around an iPhone case is a pretty large device now. I mean, I kind of made fun of the Galaxies a year and a half, 2 years ago. I saw a case for one. I think it was a spec case because it was a hard plastic thing. And I could not believe how huge the case was. And it had to be that big simply to go around this monster of a phone. So I wonder, maybe I shouldn't go with the 5.5-inch iPhone, because I kind of like putting cases. I like thinner cases. I don't like the bulky ones. But even a thin case around such a large device, it's going to be huge.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like sticking a skateboard down your pants to try to get that thing in your front pocket or your back pocket. So, you know, maybe after the Apple Watch has been out for a while and, you know, everybody's talking to their watch like Dick Tracy, I'll feel more comfortable with having something that I can just stick in a dock someplace or shove in my pocket when I'm out, my jacket pocket or even my backpack, and be away from, but still feel connected to what I need to do. But in the interim, you know, I think that the iPhone 6 is probably going to be the right thing for most of us to use. Having said that, it's clear that Apple underestimated the initial demand for iPhone 6 Pluses, because people are backordered until like November for them.
I don't understand who's in charge at Apple when it comes to this. Last year, oh, look, everybody wants the gold iPhone, and it was 4 months before you can get one if you didn't pre-order or you weren't the first in line. Every year that Apple comes out with a new iPhone, they don't seem to have this problem with the iPads, and they don't seem to have this problem with the Macs, but with the iPhones, they always miss the mark. I can't understand that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, better to be stuck with too few than too many, I guess. You know, that's...
Well, I don't know. I don't think that would ever be Apple's problems, having too many.
It certainly doesn't hurt Apple's publicity machine to be able to say yeah, there's a waiting list. There's a waiting list, and we set records for how many orders that we, or how many pre-orders we've taken. So
it definitely helped the Nintendo Wii. I mean, you probably remember that like I do. There was a waiting list for the Wii for a long time, and it kind of drove the frenzy for people to get one.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And what's hilarious about that is, you know, the Wii has kind of fallen on its or the Wii Plus has fallen on its face since then.
Wii U.
Nintendo has certainly taken the Wii U, right? Everything's Plus now.
I know, right? Plus or S or yeah. It's the original Wii became a dust magnet for most people after they bought it. They played bowling, maybe a Super Mario, and then it became a dust magnet. And then Nintendo comes out with the Wii U. People still had the Wii that they never even used. And so, I'm not going to buy that one.
Yeah, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me.
Yeah. And I have a Wii U, don't get me wrong. And I think it's a great console, I really do. But the controller is not very good, especially when it came out at the same time where everyone already had iPads. And the screen just looked terrible next to an iPad. So, Nintendo's in trouble. But let's not talk about Nintendo, because you mentioned the iWatch, and I'm curious to get your opinion on something that obviously you and I haven't even touched or looked at one in person yet. What do you think about this watch? I mean, I stopped wearing a watch years and years ago when I first got my flip phone, and I can't imagine, and I've said it on this show, I can't imagine Apple doing anything that's going to make me want to wear a watch again. And then I watched this keynote. I was excited for the iWatch. It's I to me. The Apple Watch. When I watched the keynote, but an hour later, I'm like, I don't know if I really want to watch again. I'm wavering there. What do you think?
You know, I'm in the same boat, Tim. I stopped wearing a watch when I got my first titanium PowerBook G4, as a matter of fact, way back in the day.
That was a setup, by the way, because I read your article on this.
you know, I immediately realized as soon as I started using that thing that I was going to scratch the heck out of the top case, where the wrist rest area is on these, if I didn't take my watch off. So I got out of the habit of wearing them. And then shortly thereafter, I got my first cell phone, and I realized that the cell phone had a clock on it, and said, oh, okay, well, that's all I need for my watch, or that's all I was doing with my watch at the time. So I no longer need to wear a watch. The Apple Watch kind of fits into that same sort of category of nice to have but not necessary for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be very curious to see how well it's received and how many Apple sells, because what worries me about it is that we're all going to be getting our Apple Watches and then drawing penises and sending them to one another. That's my big fear. I think that.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to happen with any new technology.
Any new technology, right? Yeah.
But no, we didn't really understand the iPhone. I mean, I was in the audience at Macworld Expo 2007. I believe you were too.
I was, yeah.
And actually, I have a very vivid memory of an after party talking to you and Jim Dalrymple about the iPhone, because it was just announced. And as great as we thought the iPhone probably was going to be, we all thought it was too expensive. It was one carrier, which everyone was grumbling about. And here we are 7-8 years later, and the iPhone is this amazing thing, and we're doing things with it that we couldn't even imagine back then. Do you think that the iWatch could possibly go down the same path?
I think that the Apple Watch is not going to go down the same path, and here's why. Because right now the Apple Watch is dependent entirely on having an iPhone. So immediately the Apple Watch is going to be going to have a much more narrow customer base than the iPhone did. You know, the iPhone was available to anybody who wanted a smartphone. And there were a lot of people, it turned out, who wanted a smartphone and who still want a smartphone. And smartphones before the iPhone came out were very different than smartphones that came after
Absolutely.
The iPhone. The iPhone was, without question, an industry-changing device and an industry-making device. I don't see the Apple Watch in the same category because it is a satellite device to the iPhone. So, you know, Tim Cook made the point on stage introducing the Apple Watch. The 200 million people right off the bat are already going to be able to wear the Apple Watch because they've got an iPhone 5 or higher. So anybody who has an iPhone 5, 5C, 5S, iPhone 6 or 6 Plus is going to be able to use this watch. And that is a lot of people. But on balance, that's a lot fewer people than can get an iPhone. So that's one reason. The second reason is that, you know, despite Apple's attempt to make the iPhone sound like a new method of communication, it's not doing anything that we can't already do through other means. Sure, the ability to draw penises on your wrist and send them to other people is fun and exciting. Sure, the ability to send your heartbeat to your wife or your girlfriend or whatever is fun and exciting. But it's not revolutionary in the same sense that visual voicemail was revolutionary or that iMessage was revolutionary. You know,
or just having a full screen web browser that was 3.5 inches that actually was a web browser. If you remember back to the smartphones, the Trios and the Blackberries, those web browsers were terrible. You weren't getting the full internet experience. But no. Even then, people were saying, well, you're not on the iPhone either because it doesn't do Flash.
Yeah. So I don't think that the price is going to change radically because this is an unsubsidized device. I mean, when the iPhone came out, yes, it was a very expensive device because that was before carrier subsidies kicked in.
Yep.
You know, but Apple kind of set the standard price, and smartphones, premium smartphones, have been in that $600, $500, $600 mark ever since then. So, you know, people expect that they're going to pay, you know, $100, $200, $300 up front. And then, you know, pay the rest of it off with their carrier over time or whatever, or just put it on a credit card and just not worry about it. And, you know, pay Morgan or pay Chase Bank, you know, for the next 5 years for it or whatever it is that you want to do. However it floats your boat to get that phone, you end up getting it. You know, this thing is a $350 piece of jewelry, and $350 is the starting point.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's what I was telling people. They say, well, it's only $350. No, that's the base model. Yeah, it goes up from there.
I'm guessing that's going to be the Sport with the cheap plastic, the one that looks like a Swatch.
Yep.
You know, when you start getting into the 18 karat gold.
Oh, that's thousands.
That's going to be a pretty penny. So,
now, do you think there's going to be a lot of companies that are coming out with accessories for it? Hey, look, you can use it as a necklace. You can use it with our bands. You can use it as, you know, you could put it in your iPhone case. It snaps right in.
Well, I've been joking that I'd like to wear it like a what do you call it?
Stopwatch?
No. A pocket watch.
Oh yeah.
You know, in a vest, so I can start looking like Boyd Crowder from Justified. I think I got to lose about 200 pounds before I can pull.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, yeah, you're a little skinnier, and although you just got to grow a little bit of hair, and you're you're right in there with Boyd.
Yeah, but of course that would also take away some of the advantages to it because it needs skin contact for the NFC payments for Apple Pay and stuff like that. But you know, I'm going to be very interested not just to see what third parties do in terms of Apple Watch accessories, if they're going to be able to do anything or if they're going to be, you know, shut out of it for a while. If Apple's going to keep the band business to itself,
they're not going to be able to.
Or if. You know, and to see how Apple evolves this product. You know, with the Apple Watch, I feel like I don't need to own one on day one, but I'm probably going to be very interested to get a version two of that.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you on that. Maybe. I'm just really on the fence, and I'm kind of leaning towards, I can't see spending $350. I can't see talking my wife into spending $350 for a watch for me. And I'm sure that would be an interesting conversation with Bonnie as well, because... they're a little more pragmatic than we are, I think, when it comes to stuff like that.
You know, it's funny you should say that. I actually haven't had a chance to talk to Bonnie about the Apple Watch except really cursorily. But I can tell you this much. Watches are her jewelry of weakness. She's not really that into, like, necklaces or earrings. She's got some nice ones, don't get me wrong, but she loves watches. So she may actually be an earlier Apple Watch adopter than I will be this time around.
Please give her the compliment that I got a friend request from her on Facebook, and I was happy to accept. And I really like her posts. She's brilliant and she's funny.
Oh,
and you're a lucky man to have such a woman as a wife, and her to have you, because I think you guys, just by reading your guys' Facebook posts, I think you guys compliment each other really well. Your opinion or your prediction. Will the iWatch be a big success, and will Apple Pay be popular?
I think that Apple Pay will be popular. I think that it will take a while to reach critical mass, but I think that we'll see it more and more. I think that the Apple Watch will have perhaps limited success at first.
I think it's going to be a slow burn.
But yeah, I think over time is something that as Apple democratizes it a little bit, you know, if Apple can work down the price from $350, and refine the design and come up with new functionality for it, I think that the Apple Watch will be a solid performer in Apple's in Apple's product line for sure. I don't think it's going to explode like the iPad did straight.
No, I don't think so either. I'm going to give you a 4.5 month time frame either direction, but I want your prediction before we see the Fire Watch from Amazon.
The Fire Watch from Amazon.
Well, we've already got the Fire Phone, which dropped after 6 weeks of being out there as a premium phone to 99 cents, which is still a little pricey to me. You know, they've got the Fire tablets and everything's Fire with Amazon. How long before we get a Fire Watch?
You know, when Amazon offers to pay me for a Fire Phone, then I'm interested.
Wait, is there a commitment, though?
Right, 2 years exactly.
Commitment? How about a 3 month commitment?
If you give me $100 and just let me keep the phone, maybe. let's see. The Amazon Fire Watch, I'm going to say by September of 2015.
Okay, great. And I'm giving you a 4.5 month buffer between, you know, that date before and after. So we'll see if that comes true. Okay. Peter, I want to thank you for coming on OWC Radio this week. It means a lot to me. I believe you were on the first iteration of the show, too. It's been a long time since I know we've actually talked on a podcast. I can't remember if it was OWC Radio, or it was the MyMac show when I was doing that one, or Tech Fan, but it's been a long time, and it's the middle of the day for both of us, so I wanted to thank you and appreciate you coming on right in the middle of a day to do this show with me. Thank you.
Tim, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, man, and it's been too long. We should do this again soon.
Absolutely. Is there anything you want to promote before we wrap up here? Any links on the internet that people can find more information about you?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. My writing is at imore.com. I encourage you to stop by and read not just what I'm writing, but what everybody else is too. And you can find me on Twitter at Flarg. That's F-L-A-R-G-H.
That is a very original screen name.
Thank you.
I would ask the origins of it, but we're on OWC Radio, and we do have a parental guidance there. So.
Okay, fair enough. Well, yeah, and that should be, it goes without saying that sometimes my tweets are not safe for work.
Absolutely, and I wouldn't have it any other way. Thanks, Peter. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tim.